Seven-term Congressman LaHood may have an R by his name, but it's his political DNA that matters more than the partisan label. LaHood is a card-carrying member of the Chicago political machine. And as an Illinois congressman from 1995 to 2009, he reveled in his power as a House appropriator. He chose the assignment on the House Appropriations Committee, he told the Peoria Journal Star, because he and his fellow pork slingers know that it puts them in a position to know where the money is at, to know the people who are doling the money out, and to be in the room when the money is being doled out. LaHood is an especially intimate crony of fellow Illinois kingmaker and Obama Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel. Their public displays of affection abound. In a House floor speech last fall, Emanuel hailed his GOP colleague as someone the framers of the Constitution would have had in their mind's eye when they thought of a member of Congress. He is an individual who, while firm in his principles, was very flexible about his opinions. Flexibility is easy when you have no fiscal conservative spine. Emanuel and LaHood teamed up to push the massive expansion of the state children's health insurance program in 2007, funded through huge cigarette tax hikes and reaching far beyond the scope of the original plan towards the goal of universal health care. They co-hosted a series of bipartisan dinners for members of Congress to forge a consensus on spending your money. LaHood also crusaded for federal funding to pay for a $20 billion O'Hare International Airport expansion at the behest of Chicago Mayor Richard Daley. And when the White House sought Republican support for the $1 trillion stimulus bill, LaHood was the go-to guy. Not a single House Republican voted for the stimulus, but former Republican Congressman LaHood got the last laugh. He now has $48 billion in stimulus money for the Department of Transportation to play with, including an $8 billion for his pet transportation cause, high-speed rail. Next Joe the Train Rider Biden, LaHood is the loudest Capitol Hill advocate for government-subsidized money loser Amtrak. The subsidies need to continue, LaHood protested in response to a 2005 Bush plan by Democrat Transportation Secretary Norm Mineta that called for reducing the Fed's role in Amtrak operations. These subsidies are the lifeblood of Amtrak continuing the kind of service they have to the college towns and the small communities in Illinois and around the country. I don't see us really tinkering with that. The stimulus funds for transportation represent what's been called the largest wave of federal transportation spending since the Eisenhower administration launched the creation of the interstate highway system. LaHood is a Klieg-like shining example of Obama's anti-earmark disingenuousness. The Wall Street Journal dubbed the transportation secretary the earmark king, but that title belongs solely to the man in the White House who pledged to ban all earmarks in the stimulus and then promptly broke the pledge by rubber-stamping billions of dollars worth of earmarks. President Obama is the earmark king. Transportation Secretary LaHood is the earmark courtier. Taxpayers for Common Sense reported that in fiscal 2008, LaHood scored $62.7 million in federal earmarks for his district, either solo or with other colleagues. The Washington Post added that LaHood directed at least $9 million of that oft-hidden, last-minute pork project money to campaign donors. LaHood has a special fetish for road-building earmarks, doling out millions to home state paving companies and projects, including an unsolicited $245,000 check in December 2007 to fix roads leading to a Springfield, Illinois cemetery where Abraham Lincoln is buried. One of LaHood's top back-scratching donors was Republican William Cellini Sr., an Illinois pal, who shares the bipartisan Chicago spirit of pay-to-play. Chicago Tribune columnist John Cass introduces you. Obama selected outgoing Illinois U.S. Representative Ray LaHood, Republican, Combine, for the post of Secretary of Transportation, putting LaHood in charge of Obama's planned $1 trillion public works bonanza being sold as a jobs bill. Every dollar that we spend, we want it spent on projects that are there not because of politics, but because they're good for the American people, Obama said. If we're building a road, it better not be a road to nowhere. Not because of politics? What does the great reformer take us for, a bunch of chumbalonis? What Obama forgot to mention is that with LaHood in charge of the roads, they'll lead to one place, Bill Cellini. Cellini, the Republican boss of Springfield, who has been indicted in the Blagojevich scandal for allegedly shaking down the producer of the movie Million Dollar Baby, is a strong LaHood ally. Cellini runs Sangamon County, and LaHood has enjoyed Cellini's political support. They also joined to help oust the last true reformer in Illinois politics, the former Senator Peter Fitzgerald. The Republican, who was denied an endorsement from his own state party after he brought federal prosecutors to Illinois with no connection to the bipartisan combine that runs things here. Republican money man Cellini is not only the Chicago political connection to machine Democrats and Mayor Richard Daley's City Hall and a Blagojevich fundraiser, he's also the boss of the Illinois Asphalt Pavement Association. They're the guys behind the guys who pour that hot, sticky stuff on the roads but don't get their cashmere sweaters dirty and drive black Escalades to the job site before wheeling off for some ossobuco at Volare or other fine restaurants. Cellini was indicted in the fall of 2008 after a criminal investigation spearheaded by Northern District U.S. Attorney Patrick J. Fitzgerald. The charges? Shaking down government vendors to raise money for, wait for it, disgraced Democratic Governor Rod Blagojevich. Asked to explain how a lifelong Republican had insinuated himself into Blago world, Cellini once quipped before his indictment, "When we're in, and when you're in, we're in." The autumn 2008 indictment cited 30 charges of conspiracy to commit mail and wire fraud, conspiracy to commit extortion, attempted extortion, and soliciting. A new indictment released in March 2009 dropped the bribery solicitation, but the basic pay-to-play allegations should sound eerily familiar. A financial firm called Capri Capital wanted a piece of the state government pie, control and management of $200 million worth of state teachers' pension money. The Chicago political machine named its price. Cellini and others, including convicted Obama Blago real estate mogul Tony Rezko, agreed to demand that Thomas Rosenberg, the owner of Capri Capital, arrange to raise or donate substantial funds to friends of Blagojevich, and to threaten that if such funds were not forthcoming, they would block a proposed investment by the state teachers' pension fund of $220 million with Capri Capital, according to impeached former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich's criminal indictment. These are the friends of Obama's transportation secretary, an earmark-addicted influence peddler born and raised on the politics of pay-to-play. For his disregard for the taxpayers' money and an abundance of concern over how he will administer the Department of Transportation, the nonpartisan Citizens Against Government Waste designated LaHood its Porker of the Month in January 2009. Change? It's all we'll have left after Ray LaHood gets done plundering the stimulus coffers for his pet projects and pails. EPA Chief Lisa Jackson, clean as she says, not as she cleans. President Obama's choice to head the Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, Lisa Jackson, racked up a controversial record as chief eco-regulator for the state of New Jersey. But national journalists seemed more interested in her skin color than the dark spots on her resume. Diversity consultants cheered, and the Associated Press trumpeted Lisa Jackson in line to be the first black EPA chief. Jackson stressed her green credentials while posing as an adherent of sound science and regulations. In her Senate confirmation testimony, Jackson promised that science will be the backbone of what EPA does. But some of her own scientists and the EPA's own inspector general say Jackson did not practice in New Jersey what she now preaches. Critics on both the left and right pointed to an EPA's inspector general report lambasting Jackson's state agency for failing to clean up toxic sites in a timely manner and for not implementing agreements on cleanup milestones, agency responsibilities, and enforcement actions. A former senior scientist who worked for Jackson, Jeff Rook, of the activist Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility, lambasted Jackson's oversight, or rather lack of oversight, when the OIG report was released. The new EPA OIG report blasts inordinate delays and mismanagement of state-supervised Superfund cleanups performed under the authority of federal law. The report focuses on several toxic cleanup operations that had been going on for more than 20 years without completion and concludes that New Jersey has the worst track record in the nation, accounting for more than one quarter of all unresolved Superfund cleanups, more than 20 years old. Delays are primarily due to the State Department of Environmental Protection, DEP, not using legal tools available to them to force responsible parties to clean up pollution, and the U.S. EPA should step in and take over mired state-supervised cleanups. New Jersey used to have the strongest cleanup program in the country, but now it is among the worst, stated New Jersey PEER or Peer Director Bill Wolf, a former DEP analyst. We should be embarrassed that George Bush's EPA has to step in and take over pollution control in our state. In 2008, a Justice Department investigation led to several guilty pleas from New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection contractors under Jackson's watch, who were involved in a Superfund cleanup kickback conspiracy. The owner of a Camden County wastewater treatment supply company and a former contracts administrator pleaded guilty to bid rigging, fraud, and tax charges involving work at two Superfund sites in New Jersey, according to the U.S. Department of Justice. More than $410,000 in kickbacks was exchanged in the form of checks, cash, cruises, home renovations, boat trailers, and airline flights, as well as inflated invoices. Another co-conspirator was ordered to pay a $1 million criminal fine related to the conspiracy. And in March 2009, as Jackson settled into her new position at EPA, the Justice Department secured still more guilty pleas related to the kickback scheme. Risk and environmental policy analyst Jonathan Tolman of the Free Market Competitive Enterprise Institute in Washington, D.C., stated the obvious. If a Republican president had nominated a former Republican state DEP head with the exact same environmental record as Lisa Jackson, environmental groups in Washington would be howling. But all one seems to be hearing from the major environmental groups is a sound of one hand clapping. As the official cabinet nominees stumbled, bumbled, or greased their way through the nomination process, the Obama administration was installing a shadow cadre of unaccountable advisors and regulators pulling the strings. If at first you don't succeed, the White House learned, circumvent the democratic process. Chapter 5. Backroom Buddies, Dancing with the Czars. There seems to be an unwritten mandate in the Obama White House. If you can't beat 'em, czar 'em. The nomination process has proved to be a dangerous landmine for one too many Obama picks, so the vetters found a convenient way to circumvent the problem by creating a handful of new posts through presidential executive orders that require no Senate approval. No Senate review, no questions, no questions, no problems. Viva la transparency. In effect, the Obama administration has created a two-tiered government, fronted by cabinet secretaries able to withstand public scrutiny, some of them just barely, and run behind the scenes by shadow secretaries with broad powers beyond the reach of congressional accountability. A few lawmakers aren't too crazy about Obama's czar mania. Democrat Senator Robert Byrd, yes, even a broken clock is right twice a day, warned the White House in a February 2008 letter about his worries regarding the new czar positions in health care, urban affairs, energy and climate policy, and technology and management performance. I am concerned about the relationship between these new White House positions and their executive branch counterparts, Byrd wrote. Too often I have seen these lines of authority and responsibility become tangled and blurred, sometimes purposely, to shield information and to obscure the decision-making process. GOP Senator James Inhofe questioned whether hearings on Obama's pick to chair the Council on Environmental Quality, which requires Senate confirmation, were directed at the wrong person. I'm quite concerned that the chair's role has been diluted by the addition of former EPA Administrator Carol Browner as White House Climate and Energy Czar. It's one thing to create a White House coordinator slot to handle sensitive tasks that no other agency is handling. 10 days after the September 11 terrorist attacks, the Bush administration appointed a new domestic security czar to coordinate the counterterrorism efforts of more than 40 federal agencies, including the CIA, FBI, and National Guard. But Obama's czars all have cabinet counterparts already in place. While past administrations, dating back to the Nixon era, have designated such super aides, none has extended the concept as widely as Obama has, which raises another bureaucratic concern, sheer chaos. New York University professor Paul Light, who has written extensively on government organization, said that in addition to Byrd's constitutional concerns, there are so many czars in this White House, they'll be constantly bumping into each other. That chaos could serve as a useful smokescreen to obscure the true source of decision-making. If the czars are working behind the scenes, and the secretaries will be the mouthpieces of the administration, it calls into question who is actually making the policy decision, Senator Byrd concluded. Whoever is making the policy decisions needs to be accountable and available to Congress and the American public. Obama's czar class, however, operates by different rules and different ethics. Unchecked, these shadow despots with spotty records could wreak major havoc on the economy. Carol Bronner, ethically challenged energy czar. In December 2008, the Obama White House wheeled out yet another moldy old Clinton Gore corruptocrat to serve in the administration of hope and change. Obama named Carol Bronner, a neon green extremist who headed the Environmental Protection Agency from 1993 to 2000 and served as former Senator Al Gore's legislative director, to the post of Assistant to the President for Energy and Climate Change. The control freaks preferred the title Energy Czar. Perhaps they should have called her Energy Commissar, given her membership in a socialist international organ called the Commission for Sustainable World Society. By February 2009, she had already announced radical plans to declare carbon dioxide emissions a danger to the public, a move that could potentially subject not just power and chemical plants, refineries and vehicles, but also schools, hospitals, and any other emitters of carbon dioxide to costly new regulations and litigation. Initially, the White House pegged the cost of the cap and trade program supported by Bronner at $646 billion over 8 years. In March 2009, Senate staffers learned the true cost would be closer to $2 trillion. The Bronner appointment, which, like other czar appointments, bypassed the Senate confirmation process, came despite concerns about her ideological zealotry. As the Washington Examiner reported, the Socialist International Organization responded to exposure of Bronner's membership by scrubbing its website to remove Bronner's photo and biography. Such whitewashing is par for the course for Bronner. On her last day as Clinton's EPA chief nearly 8 years ago, Bronner oversaw the destruction of agency computer files in brazen violation of a federal judge's order requiring the agency to preserve its records. This from a public official who bragged about her tenure. "One of the things I'm the proudest of at APA is the work we've done to expand the public's right to know." Asked to explain her track-covering actions, the savvy career lawyer Bronner played dumb. Figuratively batting her eyelashes, she claimed she had no clue about a court injunction signed by U.S. District Judge Royce Lamberth on the same day she commanded an underling to wipe her hard drives clean. Golly gee willikers, how could that have slipped by her? According to testimony in a Freedom of Information lawsuit filed against EPA by the Landmark Legal Foundation, a Virginia-based conservative legal watchdog group, Bronner commanded a computer technician on January 19, 2001, "I would like my files deleted. I want you to delete my files." Not coincidentally, the Landmark Legal Foundation had been pressing Bronner to fully and publicly disclose the names of any special interest groups that might have influenced her wave of last-minute regulatory actions. 2 days before she told her technician to purge all her records, EPA had gone to court to file a motion opposing the federal court injunction protecting those government documents. Plausible deniability? Not bloody likely. Incredibly, Bronner asserted that there was no work-related material on her work computer. She explained she was merely cleaning the hard drive of computer games she had downloaded for her son and that she wanted to expunge the hard drive as a courtesy to the incoming Bush administration. How thoughtful. Later, her agency admitted that three other top EPA officials had their computers erased, despite the federal court order and ongoing Freedom of Information Act case. The record is silent on whether Bronner's son was playing games on their desktops, too. A further belated admission revealed that the agency had failed to search Bronner's office for public documents as required by Landmark's public disclosure lawsuit. Not only were all the top officials' hard drives cleared and reformatted, but email backup tapes were erased and reused in violation of records preservation practices. After a 2-year legal battle, Judge Lamberth finally held the EPA in contempt of court for the systemic file destruction, actions Lamberth lambasted as contumacious conduct. As is typical in Washington, Browner weaseled out of any serious repercussions. Lamberth inexplicably decided that slapping the agency as a whole with contempt rather than any individual would deter future cover-ups. Browner has crossed the line and violated public trust before in her capacity as Echo Chief. Early in her first term as EPA head, Browner got caught by a congressional subcommittee using taxpayer funds to create and send out illegal lobbying material to over 100 grassroots environmental lobbying organizations. Browner exploited her office to orchestrate a political campaign by left-wing groups who turned around and attacked Republican lawmakers for supporting regulatory reform. These are the very same groups, anti-business, anti-sound science, pro-eco-hysteria, that Browner will be working with arm-in-arm as Obama's energy czar. A bipartisan subcommittee of the House Government Reform and Oversight Committee reprimanded Browner, concluding, "The concerted EPA actions appear to fit the definition of prohibited grassroots lobbying." The prima facie case is strong that some EPA officials may have violated the criminal law. Manhattan Institute scholar Max Schultz also points out that Browner was the driving force behind the federal government's effort to force General Electric Company to spend $490 million to dredge New York's Hudson River to rid it of polychlorinated biphenyls, PCBs, that, because they were buried under layers of silt, posed no environmental harm. Some of her employees, Schultz recalled, wound up facing criminal charges for falsifying evidence and manipulating lab results. Then there's Browner's husband, Tom Downey. While Team Obama pays lip service to breaking old Washington lobbying habits, Browner and Downey represent the prototypical influence-peddling power couple. In 2006, the pair teamed up on behalf of infamous Dubai Ports World, the United Arab Emirate-owned company that unsuccessfully sought to take over operations of 6 major U.S. ports. Browner was a principal in the international consulting firm of her old Clinton pal and former Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright. Browner and Downey, whose own firm lobbied for Dubai Ports World, met with New York Senator Charles Schumer to try and quell congressional opposition. All deny that lobbying took place. It was for informational purposes, an Albright Group spokeswoman told the Wall Street Journal, yet Downey was named by Washingtonian magazine as one of Washington's top 50 lobbyists. His clients have included foreign governments, drug and insurance companies, and major energy companies, including Chevron and the Standard Renewable Energy Group, which will no doubt come under the regulatory purview of his broadly empowered energy czar wife. Obama's stringent lobbying rules do not apply to spouses. The White House blithely claims that administration officials will recuse themselves from any issue involving a spouse. But how exactly can Browner recuse herself from the very core duties of her job, which include targeting carbon emissions, enacting onerous global warming reduction policies, and regulating the very industry her husband represented for years? This is particularly troubling, given Browner's husband's past. Conflict of interest and abuse of power seem to be Downey's specialty. He was a Democrat congressman in New York for nearly 2 decades before losing his seat during the House banking scandal. Downey racked up overdrafts on 151 checks worth $83,000 at the House bank while his wife held a patronage job as an auditor in the House office that ran the House bank. An undercover ABC News investigation in 1990 showed him lolling on a beach during a congressional junket to Barbados. Reflecting on Downey's defeat in 1992 and the loss of his long-ago image as an upstart reformer, one of Downey's congressional colleagues told the New York Times, "You live in Washington, you just get sucked into Washington." Thanks to Barack Obama, 2 more old crony players have been sucked back into the Beltway swamp to wield their joint power and influence. Adolfo Carrion, ethically stained urban czar. Former Bronx Borough President Adolfo Carrion Jr. is a man in Barack Obama's own image. Son of immigrants, check. Young, check. Charismatic, check. Ambitious, check. Oh, and embroiled in pay-for-play scandals that would make convicted Obama crony developer Tony Rezko and the Chicago political machine proud. Checkity check check. A perfect fit for the Obama administration. As with energy czar Carol Bronner, the Obama White House circumvented the normal confirmation process for Carrion by creating a new executive position and office for him, head of the White House Office of Urban Affairs. Voila, urban czar. But doesn't the president already have a Secretary of Housing and Urban Development? Why, yes, yes he does. That spot went to Harvard grad and former Clinton HUD official Sean Donovan, who moved up from his role as New York City Commissioner of Housing and Development. Grievance groups, however, were miffed that the HUD job didn't go to a racial or ethnic minority. Donovan is white. HUD is a notorious bastion of cronyism of color. Enter Carrion. The Puerto Rican Democrat initially supported Hillary Clinton in the presidential primaries, but threw his whole being into campaigning for Obama after Clinton bowed out. As a reward for turning out the Latino vote, Obama handed him the keys to the urban czar's office, where he will have the power to shower federal dollars on urban areas and coordinate urban policy in traditional areas such as education, healthcare, and public safety, as he described the position to the Washington Post. The budget and staffing for the office are unknown. According to the executive order establishing the office, Carrion's purview is sweeping. His mission: to provide leadership for and coordinate the development of the policy agenda for urban America across executive departments and agencies. To coordinate all aspects of urban policy. To work with executive departments and agencies to ensure that appropriate consideration is given by such departments and agencies to the potential impact of their actions on urban areas. To work with executive departments and agencies, including the Office of Management and Budget, to ensure that federal government dollars targeted to urban areas are effectively spent on the highest impact programs, and to engage in outreach and work closely with state and local officials, with nonprofit organizations, and with the private sector, both in seeking input regarding the development of a comprehensive urban policy and in ensuring that the implementation of federal programs advances the objectives of that policy. In practice, the job empowers Carrion to carry out the pay-to-play schemes that sullied his tenure in the Bronx on a nationwide scale. It's Obama-approved old-school patronage dressed up as the new urban renewal. The New York Daily News did the work the Obama vetters failed to do and spearheaded the investigation into Carrion's cash-and-carry arrangements with a slew of Big Apple developers. The Bronx Beep, as borough presidents are known, took tens of thousands of dollars in donations from the real estate firms just before and after the developers snagged lucrative deals or crucial zoning changes for their projects. In turn, he made millions in public tax dollars available to his cronies. Most of the contributions, the Daily News reported, were organized and well-timed. The quid pro quos couldn't be more obvious. One developer, Jonathan Corin, was gunning for a deal to build 166 units of affordable housing in the Park Chester neighborhood. He did something he had never done before in order to grease the wheels. Corin registered as a fundraiser for Carrion. 3 weeks after Corin drummed up more than $2,500 from multiple contributors, Carrion greenlighted his project. The Daily News added that on another single day, he raised an additional $1,255 for Carrion, less than a month before the Planning Commission, which includes a Carrion appointee, approved the deal. Next, Corin raised $6,532 for Carrion from 43 donors. Asked about the purpose of fundraising for Carrion just before he reviewed the project, Corin replied, "None, other than, to be perfectly honest with you, at that time I became aware of his campaign." It is what it is. It is what it is. And there was plenty more where that came from. Two of the largest Carrion donors were Atlantic Development Group and Latino-themed Boricua College. The developers sought approval, regulatory changes, and funding for a public project to construct housing and a college tower called Boricua Village. Atlantic and Boricua chipped in nearly $70,000 to Carrion's campaign coffers as they negotiated the deal. Eight donations from college officials totaling $8,750 arrived for Carrion one spring day in 2006, not long after the first application for the construction project had been filed. More would follow. For their share, Atlantic's employees contributed a total of $52,400, the largest single source of carry-on campaign money, the Daily News reported. Another firm that paid to play, BTM Development Partners. The developers sought a critical zoning change for a project that had raised community ire over traffic and other complications. BTM executives started dashing off $1,000 checks to carry on. Not long after, they announced plans for a hotel retail complex, and just a few months later, carry on and Bronx officials approved the zoning changes necessary. Payoffs pay. Carry on went even further by bringing his cash and carry deal to his front doorstep, literally. In 2006, he hired an architect to renovate his City Island Victorian home. The architect was Hugo Subotovsky, who just happened to be seeking approval for a number of development projects in Carrion's realm. Once again, the Daily News broke the details. Once again, the Obama administration shrugged. Over 2 years, the paper reported, Carrion rubber-stamped three separate Subotovsky housing projects, including the Barriqua Village Plan. Carrion delivered $3 million in taxpayer funds to one of the developments in May 2008. During the time period that he approved the deals, Carrion failed to pay Subotovsky for the renovation work on his home, which included the addition of a porch and balcony at a reported cost of about $36,000, including $3,627.50 in architectural fees. It is illegal for an elected official to accept home improvement renovations as a gift from an architect seeking business from the city. Carrion claimed in March 2009 that he hadn't paid the bills because he was waiting for a final survey that had not yet been filed with the city. The work was finished in early 2007. Similar arrangements involving home renovation freebies from corporate suitors resulted in multiple criminal convictions for entrenched Alaska GOP Senator Ted Stevens and forced the resignation of Republican former Connecticut Governor John Rowland. But there was barely a peep from the Beltway's clean government types about Carrion's smelly deals. On March 11, 2009, White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs was asked about the growing scandal. Gibbs glibly brushed it off. Question. Robert, two things. What's the concern from the White House about Adolfo Carrion? This current controversy about him, this possible conflict of interest? Mr. Gibbs, well, I think I don't have a whole lot to add from what was in, has been in the papers, and what Mr. Carrion has said about this. Question, but are you concerned that he has not or will not pay this alleged $32,000 for this porch and balcony? I mean, is that all he needs to do? What does he need to do to clear up this controversy in the White House's opinion? Mr. Gibbs, well, I think the quote says that when the work is complete, that the bill will be paid, and certainly that would be the expectation. Fortunately, the Obama administration's apathy did not infect the Bronx District Attorney's office. The facts, as reported, raise questions that we are looking to get answers to, Stephen Reed, a spokesman for the Bronx DA, told the Associated Press. Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, CREW, generally a left-leaning government watchdog group, pressed Attorney General Eric Holder to investigate Carrion. If the era of pay-to-play politics is over, Adolfo Carrion did not get the message, Melanie Sloan, executive director of CREW, said in a statement. And Dick Dady, executive director of another watchdog group, Citizens Union, challenged Carrion's judgment. It is irresponsible for an elected official not to conduct his personal affairs above board and avoid any perceived conflict. He should have paid the architect before now, given his role as borough president and the architect's involvement with development projects. Compensating the architect, however, would not allay doubts and concerns about Carrion's ethics and fiscal responsibility. City records showed that in his last 2 years as borough president, he squandered nearly $20,000 on a teleprompter, stage equipment, and lights to conduct lavish state-of-the-borough tours. Spent $24,000 on overnight travel and conferences, including $5,295 at a four-star San Juan resort and casino, charged a satellite radio subscription to taxpayers because it was important to keep him mobile. $8,000 plus for picture frames and mats, and was the only borough president in New York City to stick the public with his $13,000 bill for membership to a county executive organization. Lucas Herbert, a community urban planner who had dared to oppose Carrion's aggressive push for the city's taxpayer-funded Yankee Stadium development, summed up Carrion's appointment most succinctly. "I thought when people voted for Obama, they were voting for change. But Carrion is just more of the same." Nancy DeParle, health czar with deep corporate ties. In early March 2009, following the humiliating debacle involving corruption plague nominee Tom Daschle, President Obama announced the appointment of Kansas Democrat Governor Kathleen Sebelius as Health and Human Services Secretary. But Sebelius couldn't have been completely thrilled. Along with her nomination requiring Senate confirmation, the White House unveiled a new health czar to direct the White House Office for Health Reform. No hearings necessary, no questions asked. The position went to Nancy Ann Min DeParle, a Clinton-era official who ran Medicare and Medicaid as head of the Healthcare Financing Administration, now known as the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. DeParle oversaw $600 billion in annual federal spending on healthcare to 74 million Americans. She then parlayed her government experience into a lucrative private sector stint. In 2007, she and husband Jason DeParle, a New York Times reporter, spent nearly $3 million for a six-bedroom, six-bath colonial in exclusive Chevy Chase, Maryland. Despite President Obama's loud denunciations of the revolving door lobbyist culture in Washington, DeParle's industry ties didn't bother the White House in the least. DeParle served as an investment advisor at J.P. Morgan Partners, LLC, a private equity division of J.P. Morgan Chase & Company, sat on the board of directors at Boston Scientific Corporation and Cerner Corporation, and held directorships at Accredo Health Group Incorporated, now owned by Medco Health Solutions, Triad Hospitals, now part of Community Health Systems, Guidant Corporation, now part of Boston Scientific, and DaVita Corporation, among others. In all, she sat on at least 10 boards while advising J.P. Morgan and working as managing director at a private equity firm, CCMP Capital. From 2002 to 2008, while holding all those titles, DeParle also served as a member of the Government-Chartered Medicare Payment Advisory Committee, MedPAC, an influential panel that advises Congress on what Medicare should cover and at what price. In 2006 and 2007 alone, DeParle collected at least $3.5 million from fees and the sale and awards of stock from healthcare businesses whose businesses will likely fall under her jurisdiction, according to the Chicago Tribune. That amount likely represents a small portion of DeParle's corporate earnings since 2001. Philip Klein of the American Spectator concluded, "DeParle's journey from the public sector to the private sector and back again would seem to represent the type of revolving door relationship between Washington and corporate America that President Obama pledged to put an end to during the campaign and in an executive order. The point is not that administration officials should be barred if they have any ties to business or any past lobbying experience that might raise conflict of interest questions. Indeed, DeParle's significant private sector experience could be a strength. The point is that the Obama administration has taken a self-aggrandizing stand against hiring such players, while hiring them left and right." As with previous czar questions, White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs shrugged off concerns about DeParle's industry ties. Question: Robert, I just wanted to ask about Nancy DeParle and the fact that she sits on corporate boards that have health and medical-related interests. Does the administration view that as any potential conflict of interest? Are there any potential problems there? Mr. Gibbs: No. I mean, obviously, the White House has confidence in her and her abilities as part of the health care reform effort here. DeParle, the White House announced, would not need a waiver to the president's famous executive order requiring appointees to pledge not to participate in any particular matter involving specific parties that is directly and substantially related to any former employer or former clients, including regulations and contracts, for a period of 2 years from the date of his or her appointment. The health czar will simply resign from all her corporate boards and directorships and recuse herself from any issue that would directly impact in a significant way any of the companies for which she was a director, according to an anonymous administration official quoted by Politico. White House spokesman Tommy Vietor stated that Nancy will recuse from each and every particular matter involving a specific company on whose board she served. Unfortunately, it's not so simple. It's hard to imagine any healthcare reform-related issue that won't involve one of DePauw's vast array of former employers, clients, and corporate boards in the healthcare industry. She earned at least $376,000 from Cerner Corporation, for example, which specializes in health information technology. As health czar, DePauw will have unmeasured clout in directing $19 billion of federal stimulus money earmarked for, yes, health information technology. GOP Congressman Daryl Issa of California stated the obvious. There's no question that there will be a large presidential earmark for integrating a data system to try to reduce costs, to try to put people's health records all into a single database. A lot of these efficiencies, although merited, are going to lead to picking very large multi-billion dollar winners, and she's going to be at the center of it all. Financial writer Richard Gibbons notes that Cerner's annual revenues are about $1.7 billion. So even a fraction of the $19 billion can make a huge difference to Cerner's bottom line. Nevertheless, liberal Beltway supporters see no reason for concern. An article in The Hill, quoting various ethics experts, giving the health czar a pass, declared DePauw's industry ties a non-issue. Would these ethics experts have been equally sanguine if the Bush administration had appointed a drug industry official to head up the Food and Drug Administration or an oil executive to head up the Department of Energy? Jonathan Cohn at the New Republic wrote that he found no examples of worrisome behavior, and one assumes the White House checked her private sector career a lot more carefully than I did. If their vetting had turned up anything even remotely disqualifying, it seems unlikely that they would be tapping her, because, you know, all of Obama's other appointees were vetted with such meticulous care. It is our view and the view of counsel here that the incidence of that will be very low, an Obama administration official reassured the New York Times when asked how frequently DePauw might have to recuse herself. The Times, which employs DePauw's husband, neglected to point out the obvious. If she were, in fact, to recuse herself from such issues, if she were to abide not just by the letter but by the spirit of Obama's conflict of interest policy, Nancy DePauw would not have very much left to do. Steve Chooch Ratner, the Auto Czar's Shady Tinseltown Trade. Before heading up the Obama administration's auto bailout task force, Stephen Ratner was a money manager at the Quadrangle Group, a high-octane Wall Street investment fund. In October 2004, Ratner paid a visit to then-Deputy Comptroller of New York, David Loglisi, to solicit an investment for Quadrangle from the New York State Retirement Fund, according to an April 2009 Securities and Exchange Commission complaint and the Wall Street Journal. In January 2005, Loglisi arranged a meeting between one of his brothers and Ratner to discuss acquiring the DVD distribution rights to a low-budget comedy called Chooch for $88,841. Of course, it's neither unethical nor illegal to finance a movie, even a really bad one, but Chooch wasn't produced by just anyone. It was produced by David Loglisi and his brothers, the same David Loglisi who at the time was the Deputy Comptroller of New York, the same David Loglisi whom Ratner had solicited for a pension fund investment just 3 months earlier. A few weeks after the DVD deal was completed, David Loglisi personally informed Ratner that the New York Retirement Fund would be making a $100 million investment in the Quadrangle Fund. According to the SEC complaint, Loglisi never disclosed the Chooch deal to either the Retirement Fund's Investment Advisory Committee or to other members of the comptroller's staff. Loglisi is now under indictment, but neither Quadrangle nor Ratner has been accused of wrongdoing. The investigation by Securities and Exchange Commission, SEC officials, and the New York Attorney General, however, is not over. According to the Journal, the next phase of the investigation will focus on Quadrangle and other investment firms that received state retirement money. In addition to the DVD deal, federal and state investigators are looking at a $1.1 million finder's fee paid by Quadrangle to an agent named Henry Morris, even though, according to the SEC complaint, Loglisi was already negotiating the investment directly with Quadrangle by the time the firm retained Morris. A spokesman for the Treasury Department said Ratner disclosed the SEC Quadrangle investigation before his appointment. A White House spokesman in April 2009 said President Obama remains fully supportive of Ratner. Naturally, New York wasn't the only state in which Ratner worked his magic. In 2005, Quadrangle won a $20 million contract from the New Mexico State Investment Council, headed by New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson, later to be a disgraced Obama Commerce Secretary nominee. Ratner donated a total of $20,000 to Richardson's 2002 and 2006 gubernatorial campaigns. From 2004 to 2009, Quadringle employed New Mexico Senator Jeff Bingaman's son. At some point during that period, Ratner had lunch with Senator Bingaman at Quadringle's offices in New York. No word on whether they discussed Chooch. Technology czar, Vivek Kundra, petty thief, clueless chief. Whoever thinks putting a shoplifter in charge of the entire federal government's information security infrastructure is a good idea. Raise your hands. Anybody? Well, the Obama White House has complete confidence in Vivek Kundra, the 34-year-old whiz kid named Federal Chief Information Officer, CIO, in March 2009, despite his criminal history. As first reported by blogger Ed Morrissey at hotair.com, Kundra was convicted of misdemeanor theft. He stole a handful of men's shirts from a JCPenney's department store and ran from police in a failed attempt to evade arrest. Morrissey, a former call center manager for the burglary and alarm business, points out that his employees in the private workforce had to be licensed. In some of those states, any adult theft conviction at all would be disqualifying. But such high standards for technology security czars and the government workforce apparently do not exist. Only after Morrissey pestered the White House, and only after mainstream media outlets picked up on Morrissey's reporting, did the White House finally acknowledge Kundra's criminal past. Kundra was a 21-year-old adult at the time of his attempted thievery and attempted escape from the police. From the White House's poo-pooing of the incident as a youthful indiscretion, you might have thought the digits in his age were reversed. You will find no acknowledgement of Kundra's troubles on the official White House website. Instead, President Obama effuses about his technology czar's depth of experience in the technology arena and commitment to lowering the cost of government operations. As the nation's CIO, Kundra will play a key role in making sure our government is running in the most secure, open, and efficient way possible. But the aura of security and openness was further thrown into doubt in March when an FBI search warrant was issued at Kundra's office. He was serving as the chief technology officer of the District of Columbia before moving over to the White House. During the transition, two of Kundra's underlings, Yusuf Akar and Sushil Bansal, were charged in an alleged scheme of bribery, kickbacks, ghost employees, and forged timesheets. Kundra was put on leave for 5 days and then reinstated after the feds informed him that he was neither a subject nor a target of the investigation. Team Obama emphasized that Kundra had no idea what was going on in his workplace, which employed about 300 workers. But if his claimed ignorance is supposed to exonerate Kundra, what does it suggest about his ability to police government technology operations across the entire federal government? And what responsibility and oversight exactly did Kundra have over the indicted employees in his office? The buck stops where? Veteran D.C. newspaper columnist Janetta Rose Bowers reported that Akar was consistently promoted by his boss, Vivek Kundra, receiving with each move increasing authority over sensitive information and operating with little supervision, according to government sources familiar with activities inside the Office of the Chief Technology Officer, or OCTO. The raid was no surprise to city and federal watchdogs, who identified a systemic lack of controls in the office, Bowers reported. Eric Krangel, a technology trade publication Silicon Alley Insider, called on Kundra to resign. No one has accused Vivek of direct wrongdoing, but Vivek's apparent obliviousness to the alleged criminal behavior in his office hardly testifies to his managerial skills, especially not given Vivek's self-promotion as a crusader against corruption. If Vivek couldn't keep tiny D.C. clean, can he handle the responsibility of an exponentially larger federal budget? Even if Vivek is clean as a whistle, his effectiveness as a reformer has already been crippled. Who won't question Vivek's motives should the new CIO call for a radical reform of our government's IT infrastructure? Is there any chance Vivek can implement real reform while we wait, over the course of months and years, for more information about what he knew to dribble out of an ongoing criminal investigation? Reforming the federal government's bloated web presence is a huge job, one we once thought Vivek Kundra was an inspired choice to tackle, but surely Vivek isn't the only person capable of taking on the .gov mess. No, but but he may be one of the few convicted petty thieves in the country who has gone on to testify, as Kundra did in 2007, on how to create a culture of accountability and innovation in order to prevent theft and fraud. The anti-crime prevention strategy of Obama's technology security chief. Takes one to know one. Chapter 6, Money Men, Lifestyles of the Rich and Liberal. Man of the people, Barack Obama was on fire. Playing to a crowd in Chester, Virginia, with his shirt sleeves rolled up, the Democratic presidential candidate took his rhetorical piñata stick to GOP rival John McCain and whacked him repeatedly for his personal wealth. Obama told the crowd that reporters had asked McCain how many houses he owned. Obama pretended to be aghast at McCain's answer. He said, "I'm not sure. I'll have to check with my staff." True quote. Obama performed a righteous head wag and mocked McCain's answer again. "I'm not sure. I'll have to check with my staff." So they asked his staff, and he said, "At least four." Barry Q. Public wrinkled his nose in disapproval and repeated McCain's words, "At least four." The one true guardian of the everyman paced back and forth across the outdoor stage, working himself into a thick, bash-the-rich lather. "Now, think about that. I guess if you think that being rich means you've got to make $5 million, and if you don't know how many houses you have, then it's not surprising that you might think the economy was fundamentally strong." The peeved populist paused for applause and laughter, then thrashed McCain again. "But if you're like me and you got one house, or you were like the millions of people who are struggling right now to keep up with their mortgage so they don't lose their home, you might have a different perspective." He who is like you wasn't finished yet. "By the way, the answer is John McCain has 7 homes. There's just a fundamental gap of understanding between John McCain's world and what people are going through every single day here in America. You don't have to be a Nobel Prize laureate economist. You just have to have a little bit of a sense of what ordinary people are going through to understand that we can't afford 8 more years or 4 more years or 1 more year of the failed economic policies that George Bush has put in place." How audacious of Obama to carry on about other politicians' homes. He seemed to have forgotten that his own $1.7 million Chicago man's was financed with a discounted mortgage from Northern Trust and infamously included a shady land swap with convicted felon donor developer Tony Rezko. A report released by the Federal Election Commission in February 2009 underscored that the Obamas received reduced loan rates, saving $300 a month or $108,000 over the life of a 30-year loan because of their high-profile positions. Northern Trust offered the super jumbo loan to the Obamas in anticipation of entering long-term financial relationships with the successful couple. This preferential treatment is not available to average Joes, with last names other than Biden, shopping for a new home. In response to a complaint by Washington, D.C.-based watchdog Judicial Watch, the FEC refused to call the Obamas' mortgage deal an illegal corporate contribution, but it was an obvious act of favor trading. Northern Trust employees had contributed $71,000 to Obama since 1990. "This was a business proposition for us," the lender's president bluntly told the Washington Post when asked about the below-market benefits of the Obamas' home loan deal. As is so often the case in political life, the scandal isn't necessarily what's illegal. The scandal is what's legal. Prominent members of Team Obama benefited from similar special home deals. Politico.com reminded readers that the Clintons secured a $1.35 million loan from Democrat pal and fundraiser Terry McAuliffe for their New York estate. PNC Mortgage further supplied the Clintons several fee deductions and waivers to its policies. Obama Special Envoy Richard Holbrooke snagged a sweetheart loan to refinance his Telluride, Colorado ski vacation home from embattled Countrywide Financial as part of its Friends of CEO Angelo Mozzillo VIP program. And Obama's close confidant Jim Johnson accepted more than $7 million in below-market rate loans from Countrywide. Obama had tapped and then dropped Johnson from his vice presidential search committee in June 2008 after his Countrywide ties became known. Johnson, who had served as CEO of government-sponsored mortgage behemoth Fannie Mae from 1991 to 1998, had failed to disclose his Countrywide perks in violation of Fannie's code of conduct, perks which increased after his departure from Fannie Mae. Informal Obama economic consultant and fellow Fannie Mae chief Franklin Raines also failed to disclose his arrangements with Countrywide. The Wall Street Journal broke the story. Property records show Mr. Johnson has received more than $7 million in loans from Countrywide since 1998, the first coming in the waning days of his Fannie Mae tenure. He borrowed $392,950 on a row house in Washington's DuPont Circle neighborhood, with the rate set for the first 5 years at 6.375%. At the time, initial rates for such loans ranged from about 6.2% to 6.5%, according to data compiled for the Wall Street Journal by HSH Associates Incorporated, which surveys lenders. Rates depend partly on how much borrowers pay in points, if any, to lower their interest charge. Records don't show whether Mr. Johnson paid points, or if so, how many. Mr. Johnson returned to Countrywide several times to finance his growing real estate holdings. In November 2001, he received a Countrywide loan of $1.3 million for a home in Palm Desert, California. The rate was 5.250% for 5 years, then became adjustable. Rates on such loans averaged about 6% to 6.2% about that time. In June 2003, Mr. Johnson obtained a $971,650 mortgage on a house in Upper Northwest Washington, D.C., with a rate of 3.875% for the first 5 years. About that time, the market average was about 4.3% to 4.9%. In January 2006, Mr. Johnson got a $5 million home equity line of credit from Countrywide on a residence in Ketchum, Idaho, near the Sun Valley Ski Resort. And in December 2007, he received a Countrywide home equity line of credit for $1.01 million and executed a $1 million promissory note in connection with that home. Mr. Raines, who succeeded Mr. Johnson at Fannie's helm at the end of 1998, became a repeat customer of Countrywide while he was CEO. 2 days before Christmas in 1999, Mr. Raines got a $1 million loan on his house in Upper Northwest Washington, D.C., refinancing it in November 2001. Property records don't show the interest rate in either case. In April 2003, Mr. Raines refinanced again with Countrywide, this time getting a 5.125% rate for the first 10 years. The average rate for such a loan around that time was about 5.5% to 5.7%. Yes, this is the same Countrywide that Obama had endlessly excoriated for its role in the subprime mortgage crisis. Obama likened the demonized lender's CEO Angelo Mozzillo to a dangerous virus in March 2008. These are the people who are responsible for infecting the economy and helping to create a home foreclosure crisis. These executives cross the line to boost their bottom line. Instead of focusing on Obama's hypocrisy, liberal Time magazine journalist Karen Tumulty cried racism, denouncing an ad that spotlighted Raines' fraud-ridden tenure at Fannie Mae. Raines, who happens to be black, presided over the mother of all financial accounting scandals at Fannie Mae, in which the institution misstated profits for years, yet escaped with a golden parachute worth an estimated $240 million in benefits. No matter to Tumulty, she decried the McCain camp's anti-Raines ad because it depicted sinister images of two black men, Obama and Raines. The ad's photos of Obama and Raines were standard headshots, some with dour expressions, others smiling. The fact that Tumulty perceived them as sinister suggested that she should perform a racism self-exam before diagnosing anyone else.
This is the end of the CD. The audiobook continues on the next CD.
Race card distractions aside, Obama campaign manager David Plouffe soldiered on with the clean hands narrative. If we're really going to crack down on the practices that cause the credit and housing crises, we're going to need a leader who doesn't owe these industries any favors. A leader above the fray, a leader unsullied by crony connections, a leader who would usher in a new kind of politics that represented the little people and abandoned the old ways of doing business. Barack Obama did a very fine job of paying lip service to such leadership. In his open letter to the public announcing his presidential candidacy, Obama lamented that Washington had become so gummed up by money and influence. He has since taken every opportunity to separate himself rhetorically from evil industry and greedy capitalists. I want to be absolutely clear that the reason I'm in public life, the reason I came to Chicago, the reason I started working with unions, the reason I march on picket lines, the reason that I am running for president is because of you, not because of folks who are writing big checks, Obama declared at an AFL-CIO debate in August 2007. On Super Tuesday, 2008, he expounded on his folksy We the People theme. The New York Times transcribed the euphoria. Maybe this year, this time, can be different. Cheers, applause. Their voices echoed from the hills of New Hampshire to the deserts of Nevada, where teachers and cooks and kitchen workers stood up to say that maybe Washington doesn't have to be run by lobbyists anymore. Cheers, applause. Maybe the voices of the American people can finally be heard again. Cheers, applause. They reached the coast of South Carolina, when people said that maybe we don't have to be divided by race and region and gender. Cheers, applause. That the crumbling schools are stealing the future of black children and white children. Cheers, applause. That we can come together and build an America that gives every child everywhere the opportunity to live out their dreams. This time can be different. Cheers, applause. And today, on this Tuesday in February, in states north and south, east and west, what began as a whisper in Springfield has swelled to a chorus of millions calling for change. Cheers, applause. It's a chorus that cannot be ignored, a chorus that cannot be deterred. This time can be different because this campaign for the presidency of the United States of America is different. Cheers, applause. Chants of yes, we can, yes, we can. Too often, Obama lectured Wall Street in March 2008, we have excused and even embraced an ethic of greed, corner-cutting and inside dealing that has always threatened the long-term stability of our economic system. Too often, we have lost that common stake in each other's prosperity.